Welcome to Beauty as a Birthright, a podcast where we decode the evolving concept of beauty from a multidimensional lens. In this space, we embark on a journey with engaging guests from all walks of life to figure out if beauty is a birthright, then what's our legacy? So let's get started.
Today, we are so excited to welcome guest Amanda Michelle, who is a direct descendant of the Guarani Nation in Paraguay and currently resides in Southern California. Her work with Activated Living focuses on bridging both worlds of our contemporary times and traditional indigenous ways through media, storytelling, art, consulting, guidance, and writing. With over a decade experience in creative fields within several formats, such as film, photography, mixed media, alternative processes, new media, film, and video, Amanda aims to express in creative forms the contemporary 21st century struggle of Indigenous people and honoring traditional ways. Welcome, Amanda.
Yay!
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here today. Mm-hmm. So on this podcast, we've been starting off by asking our guests, what is the most beautiful thing about you today?
Such a beautiful way to open.
Yeah.
Let me turn that off real quick. Most beautiful thing. So I think, like, on a superficial level, I'm feeling like I'm really like loving my hair right now.
It's cute.
It's usually more wild, and today I woke up it's just a little bit more relaxed and I kind of like it. For me also, beauty is like an essence. I don't look at it as like just superficial. So like on an essence too, like I've been really slowing down. And I've been finding so much beauty in like the everyday parts of that slowing down. So I, on both levels, like hair, loving my hair today, and also just really relishing in the slowing down process that I'm experiencing right now.
I love that. I love that you added both, because I'm all about like sharing physical, superficial beauty. It's like, yes, I look cute today. My hair just looks this fabulous today. And like showing up like, yeah. And then I think it's so interesting that you're in this phase of slowing down, because in Chinese medicine, we're in this yang phase, like we're about to actually head into summer, and it's the fire season, and it's so yang, and it's so important for people to actually ground their yin. So like slowing down is like so in sync with what's going on with
is
nature.
It so with cyclically with spring and summer, that's a time to typically slow down.
Like spring, you're supposed to use that aggressiveness of the yang energy to like push through and like awaken from the winter, and like kind of like there's this aggressive nature to spring, you know, like when you see grass or flowers like blooming, you know, it looks aggressive if you really look at it. It's like pushing through the earth, right? But in summer, because it's this full yang, there's like so much light and heat, it's important to like kind of figure out how to cultivate your yin. So whatever that looks like for you, like slowing down is a great example.
I love that. I love that I'm like cyclically
insane. Right?
Try to live my life that way. Yeah.
So, you know, we want to know more about, you come from this like really incredible background, which I think plays out into what you do. You do so many things. You're like this multimedia artist, but you're also this chef and like podcasters and all of that. Mm-hmm. So we want to get back to like your background, and you are pretty open on Instagram. Yes. And the one I looked at this one post and I thought it was so interesting of how you shared that when you were adopted, your biological mom received a call from the adoption agency. So you're adopted. Yeah. And they told her that your brother was actually adopted to a family just 20 minutes away. I'm getting chills, yeah. Right?
Just 20 minutes. I get chills just sharing it with folks. Oh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's just actually my adopted mom that got that call, not my biological.
Oh, your adopted mom. Okay.
Yeah, I haven't had contact with my biological family, but
okay.
It was my adopted mom that got that call.
I see.
Yeah.
And then you talk about how you've struggled with this pain of belonging and identity and seeing similar features, but also a similar soul in your brother when you actually finally met and connected. And I think it's this feeling of loss and identity I hear in a lot of people who are have been adopted. So getting to meet your brother and like seeing a face that looks like yours and have the similar sense of the soul. Can you share more about, I guess, this pain of belonging, identity, and family, and what that was like meeting and seeing your brother for the first time?
Oh, that's such a big question, because there's so much with that. And this is just my experience. Every adopted person, I think, experiences on multiple levels this grief, ongoing grief, ongoing loss, ongoing pain. And so for myself, in terms of that pain of belonging, it came from visually seeing that I was a brown girl with Indigenous features, adopted into a white family with a very white name. Mm-hmm. That was like, it just was, then also visually seeing all my other friends that had siblings or just larger families, how they all looked alike. And then, you know, you get this sense of like jealousy. And it's a really weird feeling of jealousy at a young age of like, why don't I look like my family? Why don't they look like me? Mm. And then that pain, it's so layered and there's so much to it. It's not like I was a depressed child. I was a very privileged lifestyle and I had a lot of things met for me and given to me, and I had access to so much, but there's still this like pain that you feel on so many different levels, emotional, mental, sometimes like you can physically feel it, you know, and with children too that are in foster care and adoption, you tend to find children that have issues with regulation of emotions and things like that as well, just because there's just so much for a tiny person to just live with. I think that most adoptees that are adopted at young ages tend to have existential crises at really mm-hmm. young ages. And so that was kind of my experience. And then I was about 5 years old when I met my brother.
Oh, wow. How old was he?
If I was five, he would have been about 1.5, 2.
Oh, a baby.
Yeah, we were both adopted at birth.
For some reason, I thought you all were much older when you first met. I love that. Okay, so you're like 5 and 1.5, like, hey.
Yeah, and, you know, I part of me, because also there's just so much that happened in my childhood. So like part of me, I'm like, is this a memory that I have? Or do I remember looking at photos of this? And I'm telling myself it's a memory. But, you know, I do remember like looking at him and being confused too. And because then my line of questioning was like, well, why didn't you adopt my brother? Mm-hmm. Like, why did this family get to adopt him? You know, so like that whole idea of adoption still at 5 years old was complex for me to understand. So then I was like, okay, so this is my brother, but he doesn't live with us, but he's still my brother. And I could tell like we had like the same nose, and it just felt really connected just immediately, just seeing like, okay, well, that's my brother. And yeah, it's a blessing. It really is a miracle. I tell that story a lot to folks also that are looking for ancestry and reclamation that feel like it might be impossible. And it's like, look, like when you are serious and that is like the dharmic path that you wish to walk on of finding where you're from, like these miracles will start happening. Like God, mm-hmm. spirit, however you identify with, like, will open this path for you. So I feel blessed that he's in my life. He's my best friend.
Oh, I love that. Oh my God. That just like, it's like you found each other, you know, like.
What are the odds too, you know, because we were both born in the capital of our country in Paraguay, but Our mother was in a community, an indigenous village. The fact that she went to the state capital twice just to work with the same agency, the same agency, and then just due to legal law, they couldn't, you know, it was a closed adoption, so they were breaking so many laws by even contacting my adopted mother. But there's like, look, like, this isn't even like protocol. We aren't allowed to do this technically, but
wow,
he's being adopted 20 minutes from where, if you're at that still current address, like, you guys will be adopted. He'll be 20 minutes away. Do you want to have a relation? And at that point too, they had to have both families to say yes. So if one said yes and one said no, then they would be like, all right, we can't, you know, do that. But both of our families fortunately said yes. And yeah,
it's really an amazing gift. And there's no such thing as a coincidence, right? I mean, yeah.
It makes you believe, like, life is so, it's just magic, you know, like.
It truly is. Even when I would have my times of, you know, like my teenage years, my early 20s, you know, my battles of like, what I thought God was, or my relation to God or spirit or anything like that. And I would always go back to that, my creation story, my, you know, my identity story, being like, no, like, there, I can't think of any other possible explanation besides a miracle and magic that is part of my story.
Yeah. And ancestors just like being like, we're going to bring these two together.
Right.
Shout out to the ancestors.
Shout out to the ancestors. They did not want us to be apart.
Well, thanks so much for sharing that, Amanda. And I'm curious too, because one of the identities that you've talked about is being transracial adoptee. And that, could you explain this term for us, or for our listeners?
Yeah, it's legal terms, translation, transracial or interracial adoption. So that means that there is the adoptee that is of one ethnicity or race that gets placed into a family that is of a different race. So like in the 80s and the 90s, there was a huge adoption wave in North America, and the International Adoption Agency started working a lot with American families and American agencies. So now we have these 80s and 90s babies that have been adopted. We are now adults. So there's a lot of folks that are speaking out now that we have more space also to speak about race, identity, and just the lived experience of adoptees, which hasn't really been given the microphone at all. You usually hear people that are either the lawmakers or people that work in social services, or the families that are seeking adoption pretty much get most of the space to speak on adoption. We don't really hear a lot from adoptees and their experience. And so now I find it really interesting that a lot of interracial adoptees are now speaking out about their lived experience.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so earlier you talked about how growing up, you would see how you didn't resemble your family, and you would see other families and how they resembled one another, and the siblings all looked alike within the same household, and how that developed like a really early, I think you used the word jealousy, or just this seed of kind of envy. So I'm curious how that impacted your experience with beauty growing up then. And then now as an adult, you know, how do you perceive beauty today now that you have, you know, this platform or microphone to then talk about these things?
So as a child, so the first part of that question of like being a child and then recognizing that I didn't look like my family, how did that impact how I looked at beauty? It sounds a little abstract, but I never, for a really long time, never put like identity and beauty or like my, how I look together. So for me, identity seemed like deeper, like a soul level. And then in terms of beauty on a superficial, like level, that was really never something that was even spoken about in the house. I didn't receive any guidance in terms of like appearance or anything like that. My adoptive mother, I think, maybe owned like 2 pairs of lipstick. I didn't have that mother-daughter experience of like learning to like put my makeup on or different parts of grooming. So then in terms of like beauty standards, it was all external of like, what did I see in movies? What did I see in magazines? And so again, also with externally, I didn't see people in magazines that looked like me. There was no representation of many brown girls. So it was a complicated relationship in terms of beauty and how I viewed myself and if I considered myself beautiful when I was younger.
Did you consider yourself beautiful when you were younger? Did you see yourself as beautiful?
No, not at all. Not at all. And I think that I expressed that, like I went through so many phases in like middle school, high school. I was super punk. I had pink hair. I had blue hair. I had played around with different color eyeshadows. So that I think was like my outward expression of trying to figure out like, what is beauty? And I just want to have fun with it.
Yeah.
And then as I got older as an adult, I started working in media. And so then I had a whole other wave of like beauty expectations and how to present yourself. And then it just kind of gave me more of a, I was just like, oh, fuck this. Like, I don't align with this. In terms of external beauty, like that kind of taught me to like really love my features and love myself. And I think that that translated into how I felt of feeling beautiful as a child in my adolescent, like never felt beautiful at all. But now that I'm done some inner work and I've explored all these things and I've learned also about my culture and I've learned about where I come from and knowing who I am, I feel that that has amplified how I view myself in terms as beautiful or what is beauty to me.
Mm-hmm. You can tell. I mean, like when I look at your pictures, right? It's exactly that. It's like this, I can't remember how you just explained it, but it's like you could see you've done a lot of work and it's so strong through pictures. Like I really? Even texted you, I'm like, oh my God, when I saw your headshots, right? And I'm like, oh my God, this is hot. Like it is like in your face, beautiful, gorgeous. And it's this, it's very powerful. There's this one picture I love. I don't think we grabbed it, but I think it's just like a headshot. You might be using it and you recently had a retreat and I think you might've been using it. It's like kind of faded and fuzzy, but it's just a close-up shot and it's such a powerful image. Like not much is going on. It's just your face, but it's like, that is so powerful and translates. Yeah. Just just your beautiful face.
Yeah. Tamsin
sent me your handle and she was like, podcast guest? I was like, yes, definitely.
Yeah. I thought you talked about like you're this transition to being in media and now you're this multimedia artist, right? So I'm always curious to, because I come from a creative background, but I've lost that. And it's something that like I want to gain back. And I think it's coming back in different ways. So I'm curious to know if like creative expression for you has anything to do with your perception or understanding of beauty in whatever way, because you do so many things, like so many creative things, you know, like art and film and video, but also food. And you do a lot of plant medicine, which we'll talk about later. So however you want to take creative expression.
Yeah. I mean, I think it just kind of reflects of like, cause some of us are just born artists. I think that a lot of folks that are just And I think that we're all artistic. I don't subscribe to that ideal that like, oh, they're just artistic, or oh, I don't have that gene in me or whatever. It's like, no, mm-hmm. we're all creative. We're all artists. It just is a matter of, do we allow ourselves, give ourselves that permission to really outwardly express it in some way. And so for myself, like in my background with, I went to art school, photography. So I was challenged by what I thought beauty was, because then I'm in all these classes where we're seeing all of these other famous photographers and portrait artists and different movements within the art movement and photography. And so that opened my eyes to like finding beauty in things that weren't considered beautiful. And then same with food, you know, I had such a shock coming back to America. I lived out of the country for 4 years. I came back in 2018, and it was this weird moment of going to a grocery store and just seeing just how manicured all of our produce is, yeah. and just how everything looks the same. And I mm-hmm. had been living in the jungle for 4 years. So I was used to,
where just were you living?
I was in Sayulita in Bucerías, in Mexico. So it's the state of Nayarit. Like you fly into Vallarta and about 45 minutes north, you're just going straight into the jungle. And it's like a beach jungle kind of subtropical.
Surf spot.
Yes. Great for if you're learning to surf or if you just love surfing. We have great, great waves. It just in other countries, like, your fruit isn't so manicured in that way.
Yeah, you're right.
And so I just remember just coming back to the United States, going to grab some fruit to make a smoothie. And it's like everything, like even our fruit is produced to look like manicured and beautiful. Like, what the fuck is this? Like, where are the bruises? Yeah. Where are the lumps and everything? And it was just this tiny moment where I was like really appreciating like the natural beauty of the foods that I had access to when I was mm-hmm. living in a different country. So like on a food level too, you know, I see the natural beauty in just the raw form of vegetables, fruits, even just the plants and everything.
Right. Love that. Like, it's just, I never even thought about that in terms of food. It's like, sometimes like when you cook a meal, you like home cooked meal, it's not the prettiest thing, but it tastes so good. And then sometimes you'll go to like a fine dining place, right? Like, and it's this like little thing with the little foam.
The foam.
And you eat it, you're like, and I feel like when I eat like fine dining food, when it's really high concept, I'm just like, I don't know if like I really enjoyed this or if I'm like trying to psych myself up for enjoying this because I know it's fine dining, it's high culture, it's costs a lot. And I'm like, wow, this is the most, this is the most amazing thing. But I'm just like, actually, I don't know. Like, I think like the noodle soup that costs like $4 off the street probably would be much more satisfying and pleasurable for me. And the fact that you're talking about food this way, it's like with UVA.
It's funny too, because in fine dining, you're trained in plating. Like that's one of the biggest mm-hmm. things that like right. a fine dining chef is going to be really meticulous about. That's going to be one of the major things that would probably go from a one or no Michelin star restaurant is making sure that you have your plating down.
Right.
And so there's so much artistry that is put in fine dining plating, for example, or like just the flavor profiles and everything. But then again, like you make a great point, because then I can sit on the side of a street and get a $4, $5, you know, noodle bowl from a wok that's been making like 150 other meals like before mm-hmm. me that day. And it just tastes so good, you know? Yeah. So I hear you on that. I agree with you.
Yeah. When I was living in China and in school there, we always called this place the Back Gate Dirty Noodle Place. Like in Mandarin, we were like the Back Gate Dirty Noodle Place. And that's where we got all of our, and then when we would talk to other people, it turned out that everyone else was calling it that too. It was just like so funny. Like we all had that in mind. But anyway, I'm curious, Amanda, to learn, because I'm sound, you know, you're really connecting to your heritage as you've gone through kind of this renaissance. And I'm curious about the Guarani people and how they see beauty, and if there's rituals within the culture that you've learned or that you've connected with, and if you can share that with us.
Yeah. So just as a preface, anything that I speak about with the Guarani tradition, it's so complex and so layered, as are many Indigenous and Native and First Nation cultures. Mm-hmm. So when I speak about Guarani culture, we also have like so many different subsects. We have like 16 different dialects within our own Indigenous language. So what I speak about is just what I know from where my lineage is from. So in terms of like beauty rituals, we don't, from what I know, we don't have, like, we don't wear makeup, you know, we live in the Amazon or the Amazon basin. If we are putting anything on our face, it's typically, like our paint, that might represent different, meanings. If we're fasting, if we're in ceremony, if there's a marriage, if there is a, you know, battles or things like that, like today we don't have tribal wars, but we do have, we have a militarized cartel that do come into our territory. And so then we do have still to this day, like our men do go out and try to protect our territories and things like that. But in terms of like putting face makeup on or anything, that doesn't really exist in our culture. And I loved this question because it kind of invited me to look a little bit deeper and speak to my elders. And when I speak about beauty to them, it was hard to translate, because when we have the word beauty in Guarani, the word is called pora, but it doesn't necessarily mean like you look beautiful. It's the essence of what beauty is. So a sunset, even if it looks beautiful, like with our Western perception of like what a beautiful sunset, in the Guarani language, if we're saying that the sunset is beautiful, it's like this essence of this sunset is so vivid, it's so beautiful, it's so just pleasant to, like, it looks pleasant, I feel pleasant looking at it. But we don't use that word bora, for example, for looks or physicality. And so then I kind of was asking more questions of like, well, we have this ideal of beauty and like, you look attractive or you want to look attractive. Does that translate in any way in Guarani or in our culture? And I was reminded, you know, like we're animistic. It's not like, it's not an ancient practice for us. It's still very well, like we're animistic people. So it makes sense now to me that we wouldn't have a ideal of what beauty is, or our women in our tribes don't have like skincare routines or anything to like continue this like ageless beauty, because we look at the essence of the person or their spirit, and that would be the essence of the beauty that they have that's within them, not necessarily externally, if that makes sense. And so it was a really like interesting concept to me when I was digging a little bit deeper for that.
Well, so then how would women cultivate their essence?
So we have three bodies that we walk with. We have our spirit body, we have our physical body, and we have our, what is roughly translated as like your rational body, like just the logic part that we have. And so when all three are honored in different ways, that tends to like allow the person within their individuality to come out. So we are of the people of the Guarani Nation, and then each person serves their part in the ecology of our tribe or of our village or our community. And when that person is honoring those three bodies in whatever way it is, that's when we're able to kind of not necessarily just cultivate like beauty, but just like the essence of who you are. And the Pages or the medicine people notice that. And if you have special gifts, that might be, you might be from a lineage of dream weavers. So people that are of the dreams, you might come from a lineage of medicine people. You might come from a lineage of other, you know, folks. So then when you see that as a young child, you see that essence, or the Pages will see that essence in you. And then depending on your tribal hierarchy, because every community is different, you're usually given either a name, or you're given a path to walk on to kind of train you as you grow into who you are mm-hmm. in that path, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I love this like concept of essence. Like it's hard for me to grasp, but it sounds very similar to Chinese medicine
yeah.
and like other traditional cultures. And then I'm also wondering, like, when you look at a lot of traditional indigenous culture, as you were talking, it really reminded me of this past episode that we did with Jamie Pineda, who is of background from the Philippines. And he talked a lot about beauty in the sense of sometimes we can look at beauty as our bodies are this kind of just this spiritual capsule and adorning ourselves with mm-hmm. beauty. Mm-hmm. And it could be through makeup, clothes, whatever. And so that was what was coming up for me when you were talking about the face paint. And then I'm sure even the clothes, it is this adornment. I see a lot of traditional indigenous culture. It's like, it's this expression of beauty through adornment in a different way that we do it in modern society, right? So it's not like this fashion trend, right? Yeah. It's something else.
Yeah, you know, that's, so for a lot of Amazonian cultures, due to colonization, due to like militarized cartel taking over territories and things like that, a lot of indigenous folk have actually lost what we would call like the regla, or their mm-hmm. traditional clothes. Mm-hmm. And so when we see like on the internet now, like people that have like we call in different, it's a different name in different cultures, but like the feathered headdresses mm-hmm. are called like the corca, like the crown. Many tribes have like kept that, but they'll be wearing civilian clothes because mm-hmm. after being forced to move so many times, we haven't been able to keep, some of us haven't been able to keep that culture of like our traditional jewelry or our traditional clothes. And so you'll see people that are still in a traditional tribe per se, but they'll be wearing like a 1980s Tommy Bahama shirt from like mm-hmm. as I've seen like maybe 7 thrift stores until it somehow landed there in the Amazon. So it's interesting because we're in an interesting time for a lot of indigenous cultures that we're actively seeing maybe an active 4 decades of them losing a lot of the traditional wear just because of what's active right now in the Amazon and in their tribes.
Yeah. And then it's also being stolen by a lot of like these big time fashion designers and like, you know, like cultural appropriation. And it's so, yeah. 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 I have so many things to ask about this. I'm curious to also know, because you do a lot of work lately around plant ceremonies. And I think in one of your posts, you had mentioned that ceremonia is the language of the unconscious, mm-hmm. right? And so how do you see beauty expressed in plant ceremonies? And this is like such a big topic because like everyone in the last few years, it's like everybody's doing the plants. Everyone's going to the Amazon, you know? Yeah. And like you and I kind of chatted about this, like how Like, how many times you got to go to the Amazon and like,
you know,
do
how
this
I feel
thing?
About that.
Yeah. I bet I can guess how you feel about that.
Yeah.
I think if you look at my Instagram, you can see how I feel about that too.
And it scares me because I feel like this is the next wave of being capitalized, appropriated, and just eliminating, erasing the people from the culture.
Yes. I mean, it is happening, right? Like, we are in the wave. I feel like, at least.
Yeah. And I say that to people a lot too, yeah, that it hasn't hit a critical mass yet, but we're in the space of where it's been happening. It's actively been happening. In terms of plant ceremonies, for example, with like ayahuasca, which is like a Hispanicized name,
yeah,
actually, that's not, if you go to many indigenous tribes, they won't know what you're talking about. In my culture, we call it yaje. But you know, that is fairly new from the 80s. And again, it's due to a lot of politicized, reasons of trying to bring money into South America, into the Amazon, profitizing off the Amazon. So it's fairly new. But to answer your question about how do I see like beauty in plant ceremony, again, very layered. Mm-hmm. In terms of the essence of the plants, you know, I tell people and I express with people that these plants have personalities just like we do. And we need to meet these plants of how we would want to be met in a sacred way. So if I'm meeting this plant with my ego or with thinking that I have to consume a lot of it because I have a lot of things that I need to be healed, then I might have a very humbling experience. I might be purging a lot. I might be going to the bathroom a lot. It might be a very unpleasant experience. Mm-hmm. And even if that is someone's experience, you know, I can find a lot of beauty in that of like, you hear a lot in medicine circles, like, oh, the plant medicine's humbling you. And this is true to an extent, but also it's like, you know what, like, hopefully this opens your mind to like, this is how I'm meeting a plant. How am I meeting my other relations?
Oh, wow.
Having volatile relations because of the way I'm meeting other people with the same type of mentality, the same type of spirit, the same type of cognitive dissonance, if you will. And that, again, might not be someone's journey. Maybe their journey is to extract and take copious amounts of plant medicine, and maybe they don't see that. But I find a lot of beauty in the experience of what this plant holds for people. And because it is so unique and it has its own personality, it's going to meet everyone in different ways. Not one plant ceremony is going to be the same for each individual. On a personal, interpersonal level, whether I'm in ceremony, sitting with other folks and being an observer or being a space holder, or what I've been doing more recently is holding space for people integrating after their ceremonies.
Right.
I love that. That is so needed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah. Yes. Oh, it is so needed. You know, I find the beauty in witnessing that person.
Because that's where like the real work is probably going to happen, right? Great. Yes. You had this awesome experience. Now you got to get back into the real world. And that transformation, that shift is so wild, right? Like, you talked a little bit about it, like living in Sayulita and then coming back, and it was this culture shock, right? So imagine, like, I've been on meditation retreats, like silent retreats, and then you come back and you're in this other world where like everything's great. And then like the world just hits you and you're like, oh my God, what is happening? And there is no support getting you coming, like this guidance to like come back to this.
Integrate back in.
Yeah.
And so, that's why it can be extractive. Like, it's important for me to mention that, because I think we hear this term a lot, and especially with Indigenous folks that are recognizing the extractive process, when we're not allowing ourselves to integrate post-ceremony, or we don't have a guide or we don't have a community that is there to hold us, because these are decontextualized ceremonies. This is not how it's done in the Amazon. We don't come with our individual intentions and sitting with 30 people that we've never met before. You know, this is very decontextualized. So when I say that it's extractive when we don't integrate afterwards, meaning that we're purely extracting the medicine, consuming, and a lot of times over consuming, and then we go back to our real life. And then depending on somebody's level of trauma, depending on somebody's history, depending on somebody also, they might have active addiction. So then they might think that they're helping themselves when really they're just utilizing something else to put a Band-Aid over another thing. That's when it becomes extractive. So it's important to say that. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm curious because you have such a unique glimpse into these individuals' lives. You see, you know that they went through ceremony and then you're helping them to transition out and to integrate back into their everyday life. So I'm super curious, what kinds of themes or similarities have you seen in helping people transition out? And kind of if you can comment on, you know, the human condition, like the good, the bad, the ugly. I'm just so curious what you see and what comes up often. You know, I'm sure there's reoccurring themes.
There are a lot of reoccurring themes. And for me, it's why I'm so called to continue doing this, because this is like where I feel like we're getting into a very dangerous space in medicine circles. So our Western perception and our Western philosophy, we really like to talk about the shadow. Right now it's a very popular topic. Pop psychology, trauma-informed therapies, new age spiritual spaces, you name it, a lot of people are talking about the shadow. If somebody isn't fully trained in understanding the depth of what that means, then it's very easy to just put that on anyone's experience, that if you've had a negative experience while being in relation to the medicine, well, it's just your shadow and you need to look at it a little bit deeply. Mm-hmm. And that's gaslighting.
Yeah.
That's straight up gaslighting.
You're already in a vulnerable place, because you wouldn't be doing this if you're
right. It's like predatory to yourself.
Totally.
Yeah.
And also, let's not forget that 99.9% of these ceremonies that people are coming back from are very costly.
Oh, yeah.
So we have a financial, like this financial reciprocity too, where we're giving money for an experience, in exchange for an experience or in exchange for healing. And then something really big might come up for somebody. And if this person, no matter how many times you sit with medicine, it doesn't mean that you're qualified to be serving the medicine to other people. And that's something that isn't spoken about a lot. And I see that when people come back out of ceremony, my main questions are like, all right, like, have you worked with this practitioner before? Did they allow contact afterwards? Like, here's my email, here's my phone number, this is my WhatsApp. Like, I'm always open and available to you, because in Indigenous communities, you always have this contact with your baje or with your medicine worker. And so even in that, when that relation is severed, it's very big. It's you're opening yourself as a person, and this might sound very abstract, but you are a person, a spiritual being, you are a portal. And when you have these connections with these plants that are the connectors, they don't call them teachers, I don't call them master teachers, these are our connectors. And as well as being in relation then also with the medicine holder or the person holding space for you or serving medicine, if all of these different lines are severed, of course, you're going to be experiencing what somebody who knows the DSM-5, like the back of their hand, might say, like, you're having psychosis, you're going through psychosis, you know?
Yeah.
And who's to say, even though these people, some people who are serving the medicine even have the capability or training or whatever to support people afterwards, because some of them shouldn't even.
It sounds like there's not a lot of them.
There isn't. Mm-hmm. And so one of the main things that I'm seeing on my end are people that are not being validated within their experience and saying that everything is just my shadow and there's no continual help or navigation. It's pretty much just like, well, that's your shadow. You got to look at it. Or if you want to buy my $10,000 packet coaching package, we can unpack that.
Yes. The master certification.
And also then people coming back experiencing what a psychologist or a psychotherapist might identify as psychosis. So a lot of I'm like blanking on the word now. What's the opposite of chronic?
Acute.
Yeah.
Acute. And psychologists aren't even trained to really understand what happened. You know, they're totally not trained into understanding what happens after this. So they're really strictly DSM, right?
Depends, because there's different types of psychology. So somebody who might be more trauma informed, that might be more like, you know, might see it in some certain way. Another person who, like my psychotherapist, he is a depth psychologist. So he looks through like a Jungian lens. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't do diagnosis. He doesn't look at DSM-5. Obviously that's something that you can always refer to, but it's more of like the soul's journey, things like that. So there's so many different types of therapy. So it really depends on the therapist and how they're moving through their practice and how they're able to support somebody afterwards. But in terms of traditional therapy, like, yeah, you're going to talk to somebody and say, hey, like, I'm seeing shadowy figures and I'm hearing voices in my head and I can't sleep and I'm having sleep paralysis and I'm having paranoid thoughts. And, you know, like, those are just kind of the main ones that I tend to hear from people. A traditional therapist might say like, yeah, let's talk about some medication for you.
Yeah.
This sounds like this is, you're going through psychosis. Mm-hmm. And this is a big conversation actually in a lot of panel conversations for like plant medicine and entheogenics, and specifically with ayahuasca or yaje, of opening the conversation for people that are scientists, psychologists, psychotherapists, people that are more in like the science realm of like understanding like the, I don't know if phenotype is that word's coming up, but I don't think that's the right word, but just like the chemical balance,
the biochemistry,
of
like
biochemistry of the plants, as mm-hmm. well as the original peoples of, because we understand this plant on multiple levels. And so it's a big conversation of like, what's the metric of wellness when it comes to utilizing plant medicine such as ayahuasca? What is considered wellness? What is considered healed? What is considered, you know, a psychotic break? What is considered, is that a spiritual awakening or is it a psychotic break? Mm-hmm. So it's a very new and very nuanced conversation that's happening right now. I don't have those answers, even as somebody who comes from a lineage of where this plant, you know, is from my people's land. I don't have those answers. But, you know, what I can say in terms of going back to your question of just these similarities that I'm seeing, unfortunately, I'm seeing, like I said, people not being validated in their experience. These people are seekers. I think that if spirituality calls you in any way, you're a natural born seeker. Mm-hmm. And so when you're seeking healing and seeking answers, and then you have a fairly traumatic or just not well experience, it's hard making meaning out of that then. And how do you make meaning out of something that might have been potentially dangerous to you when you were trying to heal?
Yeah.
Yeah, those are the big things that I see.
Oh, I love this. I think this is like, I could talk with you for hours.
It actually is our own podcast series.
It's so true.
Oh my gosh. I think I love that. I feel like this is a great transition to our last question. And it's something that we ask all of our guests, because we started this podcast with this idea of like, okay, we don't really understand what beauty is. So let's just bring on people and ask them, right? And have this evolving conversation about it. But we did say, like, we do believe beauty is a birthright. What that means, we don't know, right? but that led us to the question of like, okay, if beauty is a birthright, then what's our legacy? And so we love to ask our guests, what is the beauty legacy that you want to leave behind on this earth after you've passed?
It's so funny because whenever I hear legacy questions, mm-hmm. my mind is always just like, fuck a legacy. Can I cuss on here actually?
Yeah.
I'm always like, fuck a legacy. Like, and I know that that might be a little bit like aggressive or abrupt for some people, but I fully believe like I'm meant to be here and now. And if I'm thinking about what kind of legacy I want to leave behind, I'm not being in my present. And on top of that, my view of beauty, my definition of beauty, my experience with beauty has ebbed and flowed my entire life. You know, what I say today might be totally different tomorrow or the next month or whatever. And so I feel that in terms of, you know, trying to answer that question, it should be like, I just need to just fully love myself in every possible way. And if I can show that in some capacity, hopefully that kind of is that ripple effect for others to give them permission to love themselves in whatever way feels safe and honorable to them. And I think that, like, you know, generationally, if that's something that we can honor, you know, I think that that's really special.
Your answer is so cool, because our first guest episode, we talked to a feng shui expert, Angie Cho, and we were like, feng shui is a lot about beauty. And she's like, oh, and it's actually not really a lot about beauty. And then here we're like, what's your legacy? And you're like, F a legacy. And I'm like, okay, I love this.
I know, I love it. Because it's like such a different way of the way we think. And we're like, exactly. Oh my God, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So thank you so much, Amanda, for joining us today. And can you please tell people where they can find you and if you have any upcoming events you want to share with all of us?
So I'm the most active on Instagram. So you can find me at Activated Living on Instagram. And then I do have like a link tree so you can be connected to all my other things. Coming up, I do have an online workshop that I'm still piecing together, but it'll be out in June or July. And it's going to be contemporary storytelling and honoring like Native, Indigenous, First Nation storytelling in our contemporary times. So we're actually going to be dissecting Kendrick Lamar's Good Kids, Mad City album.
No way. Good.
And then seeing how this is actually like very reflective of Native storytelling. And then hopefully we can creatively find our own ways of how we want to tell our story.
Oh my God.
Workshop.
Can you do J. Cole's album next? Because he's a really good storyteller.
Give me all the recommendations because I love this way of teaching. So if you have a dope album, I would love to just like marinate in it and like create something.
And you should look into hip hop psychology. That's a big thing. Like hip hop psychology. Yeah, it is a thing. It's hip hop psychology is incredible. And they talk about storytelling and the power of hip hop and breaking down hip hop from like producing beats, lyrics to storytelling. And how this is a really like sideway approach to trauma healing. And yeah,
it's incredible. I'm just put that in my notes. I'm going to deep dive in that. Thank you.
Well, thank you again, Amanda, for joining us today. For our listeners, you can find Amanda's information in our show notes. Definitely check out her podcast, the Activated Living Podcast. It's so good. She puts so much thought and work, and her guests are incredible. And be sure to check out our next episode where Paige and I chat about our convo with Amanda and unpack what we've learned about our beauty legacy. See you next time. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Well, that's it for today. If you like this episode, please give us a 5-star rating, subscribe, and share it with your friends. You can follow us on Instagram at Beauty as a Birthright and say hello. If you're interested in learning more about Taoist face reading, head over to elementalarchetypes.com and follow Dr. Tamsin on Instagram at elementalarchetypes. If you like to explore beauty through your own hands, you can visit yangface.com. You may also explore Paige's Instagram at yang.face for tutorials, Chinese medicine theory, and candid thoughts on cultural appreciation.